Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hi, welcome to the Football Writers Podcast. My name is Mike Calvin. I'm joined by Tony Evans of the Evening Standard and David Priest, journalist, scout and goalkeeping coach. Now, we all knew deep down that it was too good to last. Reality was going to reassert itself sooner rather than later. Gareth Southgate has never hidden from the truth. His England team is a work in progress. I suppose the question is, how much work needs to be done? A lot, Tony?
Well, a fair amount, but probably less than in most England squads in the last 20 years. I mean, this is a good group of players. They're very young. They've got a lot to learn. But there is so much raw talent there. There's so much pace there. I think there is plenty to look forward to, and there will be setbacks like this. But, you know, Southgate has got, he's got a group of players there who can take England a long way.
Well, if that's the case, why are we panicking? You know, there's a lot of talk already. Oh, is Gareth Southgate going to sign this contract? Will he walk after the Euros? Do we need to get a little bit of perspective here?
I think there's two sides to it. You know, people keep saying that how well we did and, you know, how we should be looking to progress from there. But also there's another side of it where we were kind of lucky with the draw, as it turned out. So it was, I don't think there's any cause for real concern. But I think it's, like you said, about it being a work in progress. There's problems within the team that need solving, especially sort of in that midfield area.
Mm, yeah, Gareth has been talking about, you know, we haven't had a real playmaker for 20 years since Gazza. That is an issue, isn't it?
Well, it is, yeah. And, I mean, one of the problems is there was not a lot of goals in that midfield. He hasn't found a way of getting Dele Alli into the game properly. You know, they look a bit, they can be overrun easily. They need someone much more dynamic in the centre of midfield who can dictate the pace of the game. Because what's happened in the World Cup and here, even in periods where England have been on top, suddenly they let the game get away from them. They let the other team play it at the speed they want to, at the pace they want to. And then all of a sudden they're getting overrun. And, I mean, we've seen Harry Kane dropping back deep and working as auxiliary midfielder. He's got to try and get a handle on that. And also, he's got to organise that defence. Loads of good, raw, young talent. But, you know, at times, shambolic.
Mm. That central midfield area, David, if we're going to look to for the next generation, if you like, the one who's impressed me so far this season, I saw a little bit of him at Norwich last season, is James Maddison. Mm. Is it too early to get someone like that into the mix?
I don't think it's too early, but I think the policy that they've had at all the way through the levels, is especially at the moment, is not to promote too early. You think that's... I think even like Phil Foden,
He's been playing with the 19.
Yeah, he hasn't been playing the 21, so they're not going to push them too soon. But I think you've got to make special cases for positions where we do have a dearth of players.
Mm. One of the sort of almost what we might call a second phase player, in other words, someone who's just coming in after the World Cup, is Joe Gomez. Now, you've obviously seen him at Liverpool when he's played, because obviously he had some problems with injury-wise. He always strikes me as a modern, intelligent, modern footballer.
Yeah, without a doubt, he's very good on the ball. He's improved enormously through playing next to Van Dijk, who's very, very vocal, very talkative and a good organiser. So that's helped. The Bobby Moore comparisons, can we just put them away? Mm. He's nowhere near that. You know, he's got a long way to go. But he's the sort of player who could be a mainstay of the England and Liverpool defence for a decade.
Mm. Isn't that because, you know, what Tony's saying there about the Bobby Moore comparison, isn't that one of the great sort of recurring
problems that we've got, you know, the overhyping of younger players. You know, I saw Jadon Sancho compared to Neymar this weekend. You know, we've got to get a handle on that, get a grip.
Yeah, but I mean, I think a lot of that's just for people who, if they don't know the player and they haven't seen a lot of him, then they try and pigeonhole and say, well, this is the type of player he's going to be, or he's the one he looks like. But I think, yeah, you're right, he's a different player to likes of Bobby Moore. But again, what he does, if you're playing that back three, it allows the option of releasing Kyle Walker back to his right wing back, where he usually plays, simply because Gomez has, you know, adds that little bit more pace in there that Walker brings.
Mm. That defence, the makeup of it, you know, we've got some changes for the game on Tuesday night. Looks like a bit of a ticket selling idea. Ben Chilwell coming in. Damari Gray was very good with the under-21s. Chilwell will, you know, be basically drafted in because of the injury to Luke Shaw. Mm. That kid needs a break, doesn't he?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he's done so well coming back from all those issues. I mean, when he first went to Manchester United, he got lost. You know, he was never a bad kid, but when he was at Southampton, they monitored him very, very closely. I mean, they checked where he ate, if he was on social media, you know, after midnight, drag him into the office next day. He hadn't realised he needed his body to play professional football at the highest level. He thought he could do it with skill. And he got to United, got lost, you know, put a bit of weight on, and he really didn't get the care and attention he needed. And he got the terrible injury, and now he's come back. And he looks fantastic this season. He looks like the fullback we thought he would develop into. Not the greatest defender, gets caught up fields, but really good going forward. And his power and pace will get him out of a lot of problems. So I think we'd all love to see him back quickly. And, you know, he's really a feel-good story in the game.
He certainly is, yeah. When you were around England, you know, age group squads as a kid, David, is it easy to define the player who's going to come through and make it at a senior level? And if so, what are the qualities that he shows that others don't?
We all see through the different age groups the players that stand out. You know, it's clear, you know, when you get someone like Michael Owen, it's sort of 15, 16 years old, you can see that the way he's going to progress. But yeah, we've always had good youth sides, good under 21 sides, but it's about making that next step. And I think there's a lot of talk about that at the moment, about, you know, the pathway that the different players take, and, you know, some players going over to Europe at the moment, and other players going out on loan trying to get those minutes, because that's what's most important. And I think that's what's really makes the difference between sort of in that transition, whether they can transfer that into the older age group in the full squad, because getting those minutes, especially at an early age, you reach a point where you've had all your coaching, you know, you've had your football education, then it's about going out and doing it in sort of real life situations. It's the same as when you're taking your driving course. Mm-hmm. Take your license. You don't really learn how to drive properly and get the real experience until you get out there on the road by yourself, you know. So
yeah, if you're 22 and you're playing the under 23s, it's probably passed you by.
Mm. Yeah, definitely. And, you know, injury is always, you know, another factor. Now, Nat Chalopa, excuse me, is back in contention. He's only played what, half a dozen Premier League games in his life, probably. But someone like him at Watford has the opportunity to maybe break into that midfield equation, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, I think if he gets playing time, and at Watford he'll get plenty of playing time if he can avoid injury, then he can really make a statement and show what he can do. I think he's got enough talent, clearly, to break into the squad. It's just a case of him getting those minutes and getting playing all the time, and basically forcing his way in, because there is a vacuum in that midfield waiting for someone to come in and change the way England play. You know, make them less static, make them, you know, move the ball quicker through that midfield, because they don't do it with enough snap.
Mm. I've seen him as an 18-year-old playing in the Championship when the first time he was at Watford.
Yeah.
And he controlled the whole game from deep position in midfield, and he can get forward. He's got a good range of passion, but it was everything just went through him. And you think, you know, talk about the development of players. I thought, well, that's the start, you know. And there's a huge gap there now in his development that, you know, needs to make.
It's a good family, because, you know, the younger brother Trevo is very good as well. He's gone out on loan to Ipswich this season. I suppose, you know, what you're looking at is players having to seize the moment very, very quickly now, no matter how young you are. Is it easy to be forgotten in the game?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, especially at that age, because you always find that, certainly when you first come through, there's all this noise around you, and then you can. It's easy for you to go into a side, and you know the adrenaline's pumping through you, and there's the excitement, there's the buzz around you, and you know you're on top of the world. And then when things sort of plateau off a little bit, and sort of you just get into you know your regular game. Then, you know, it's about the mentality about being able to push yourself on again. And sometimes, you know, we talk about if you stand still in football, that you go backwards, then it's about keeping progressing and keeping pushing on and never really getting that feeling that you've made it because, you know, as soon as you, like I said, as soon as you do that, that's when you stop improving.
Mm. What's the value of this one against Switzerland? Is a traditional friendly, if you like. Yeah. Is it sort of giving time and starts to someone like Trent Alexander-Arnold, who at Liverpool has just basically grown into it, hasn't he, instantly?
Yeah, it's a time to experiment, and it gives you a chance to give people who are not getting playing time a bit of playing time. I think it's important. This game's especially important to Southgate because he's got to look. I mean, there's problems in all of the departments. There's a lot to be pleased about in the defence, midfield and attack, but all of them have issues that need sorting out if they're going to be the team they want to be. So this gives them a chance to do it, which you wouldn't necessarily do against Spain. So it'll give Trent a chance to play. I mean, he's got so much potential, it's untrue.
He's an impressive lad as well, isn't he?
He is. He's a really nice, intelligent, sort of grounded person. And so, I mean, I think he will develop into a really good player, whether it's in midfield or at full back. Is open to question because he's got such a good passing range and such a good touch. He can play further forward, but we'll give him a chance. He's probably not quite there in England terms yet, but by the time the tournament rolls around in 2 years, I'd expect him to be.
Mm. And also after this game, you've got away games in Croatia and Spain. Heaven forfend you lose all three games until then, so, you know, six on the bounce that you lose, that's when the balloons will go up. If you look at those type of fixtures, do they actually give you an idea of the real value of the Nations Cup? Because there is a little bit more edge to it, isn't there?
Yeah, but I also think that there could be a case for if they are competitive and they're, you're worried about the relegation from that top-tier group, then... You know, in a game where you might blood somebody or give somebody a bit of experience, you might hold back and go for somebody who's got a few more caps. There's a case for that. But also as well, I think it's just a case of trying to make these games more entertaining and more competitive for the people who are watching it as well.
Because the reality is a lot of the teams, across Europe are in this transitional phase anyway. You look at Germany, for instance, they're trying out Josh Kimmich as a holder, a midfield holder. So I suppose that's the territory, isn't it?
Yeah, after a World Cup, there's always going to be people are going to retire, walk from international football, or people who are going to be surplus to requirements because, by 2 years' time, they're going to be over the top. And so, it's a time of change all round. I mean, you look at the changes with Spain and actually, they were very positive changes, but it's a different group of players. It's a different feeling to the Spain team. So, there's a lot of that going on, and it'll take probably the best part of the season for it to stabilise.
Mm. A lot of questions from the viewers and the listeners around International Week, so I think it fits in nicely that we talk about that now. Russell Davies gets us going. What has happened to England's striking options? There's very little behind Kane and Rashford. And while we've got good young players coming through, not many seem to be forwards.
Well, I disagree, really, because if you look at the under-21s, the under-21s had loads of forwards. Of course, it was a 0-0 draw last week. but there is loads of potential there. I think, unfortunately, Vardy has reached the age where he won't be around for too long in terms of the international game. Sturridge, who should be the man who spearheads England, for various reasons, is never going to do it. But I think in the under-21s, there's a whole group of them who have got the potential to actually stand up and play alongside Harry Kane. Well, not quite alongside Harry Kane because obviously the system, they like to have him up there on his own. But I do think the squad was short. putting only three attackers into this squad, I think, was a mistake by Southgate. I would have taken a couple of the under-21s, put them in there, and left a couple of defenders about because it was bottom-heavy with defenders.
I think it's there's two ways to look at this. I think, one, it's a bit of supply and demand. Like I said, most teams play with one up front now. So there's more call for your attacking forwards, attacking midfielders who are sort of like haven't really got a defined position. But also, to play that role, you have to be exceptional in a lot of ways. You know, if you're playing two up front before, you'd obviously somebody would be better at hold up play, a bit stronger in the air, somebody a little bit quicker. That was the old fashioned type of partnership. Where now you have to be, you know, someone like Didier Drogba redefined that role. And he was exceptional at a lot of stuff, and that's what you've got to be. Mm-hmm. Harry Kane, he's probably, if you look at his positions that he takes up on the pitch, he doesn't really take up with positions, you know, in the build-up player of a typical number nine in that role. He's always, like you said, he's always very deep, mm-hmm. probably takes up positions more like a 10 or even a false nine. So he's, I think that's the another thing where you have to have the same, you have to have the attitude as well. Because you've got to be as selfless as you are selfish. Because you've got to do all that work round outside the box, but then have a different kind of attitude when you're in the box as well. Mm. And it takes a special kind of sort of attitude and character to be like that. You think the people who thrive like that, like Lewandowski, he's a great all-round striker, and there's not many of them about who are so well-rounded as they are.
Mm. One from... someone calling himself or herself the ordinary one, which suggests to me that might not be a Man United fan. Would the Premier League be better if the league itself continued through the international break? I suppose rugby's the example of that. Would teams be so eager to send youth players out on loan if they had to use them to cover the big stars playing for their country?
Hmm. I think the squads are big enough anyway to cover it in many ways, but I don't think it's ever happened. I think people want to see the big players playing in the Premier League, and I think there'd be so much resistance to it. It's untrue. I don't think it. I mean, I'm not a big rugby fan, but I don't think it works brilliantly in rugby either.
Mm. Do you agree with that, Dave?
Yeah, I don't think it's workable. Never mind the fans of the Premier League. They want the best product out there that they possibly can, and it wouldn't be. The only suggestion I can make is that perhaps one of the cups, maybe it's the League Cup, could be played in those weeks.
Mm.
Because then you've got no choice but to play the younger players or the players who aren't playing. So it's... Mm. Maybe you could do that, I don't know.
The other thing is, I mean, there are times during the international breaks when, actually, if it's friendlies, you'll give people a rest, like Harry Kane, who looks desperately in need of a rest. Mm. You'd think that Southgate should rest him against Switzerland, and that, so you have that, and you rest them for the... You'd rest them for, the League Cup, so I think it wouldn't work for clubs, no matter how you tried to do it.
Yeah. Sort of a couple of broad ones on the Nations League itself. Thomas O'Day says, do you think it would be successful or would it have been better to have actually had a revamp of qualifying? And Luke Pauly adds, do you think the Nations League will achieve its goals of getting fans more engaged with international football?
I think if we're going to stay in that top tier of international teams, then there's going to be more interest if you are like playing the likes of Italy, maybe Croatia. We felt lucky with Croatia, really, because I think it's a great game for us to, it's like measure ourselves against how far we've come since the World Cup. Mm. If we can, and try and sort of improve on what went wrong in that game as well. So we've been lucky in that sense. But it's a little bit in between. I mean, you said there about what happens if we lose the next two games and then it's six games of Gareth Southgate's lost in a row. When you think, well, he's not going to lose his job over the Nations League. You know, if it was in qualifying for the Euros or whatever, it's a little different.
Mm. Brad Dobbing asks, with all the fuss about switching allegiances, I think Declan Rice is the current case in point, and the Nation League coming in, do we hopefully get away from gifting caps at international level? Are you in favour of bringing back international B teams?
No, not really. I mean, it's... I just don't think there's any need for it. You know, it's... these didn't attract that much attention. I don't think they give you that much... I mean, in many ways, it's like when you put the under-21s, why would you have international B teams? It's just... It seems a strange idea, a retrograde step.
Okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's different now. It's a different environment now than when you used to have B teams before. I think, you know, you're looking at sort of like 80% of English players made up the First Division or Premier League teams. We're now sort of just above 30%. Mm. So that maybe the pool isn't there. I don't know. I mean, back in Denmark, they do a league team. So it's full of players who are uncapped and playing at home in Denmark. Just to give them the experience of international football and sort of widen the pool of players at that level.
Mm. Okay, the final question, which will probably ease us into a further debate about the club game. This is from Nick from Manchester. Just a question on Brentford. Are we looking at the new Bournemouth? Is Dean Smith the most underrated manager outside of the Premier League?
Well, they've had a good start to the season. They've been there or thereabouts for the past 3 or 4 years. They do things differently at Brentford. Their approach to the game involves a lot of analytics and a lot of different a different variety of analytics to most clubs as well. And I think Dean Smith's doing a great job. I did next Bournemouth. Possibly. I think they'll probably find the championship a bit too strong for them this year, but I certainly see them being in the playoffs. And when you're in the playoffs, who knows?
Yeah, I've looked at Brentford quite deeply, and you're right about the analytics. But I think also it's the efficiency of their scouting system. You know, they're watching the same players, and other scouts have admitted this to me, they're watching the same players as everyone else, but they're more decisive. Bang, they go and get the player.
Well, because they have the data behind them as well, it's probably, you know, they don't have to watch the players as much or take as much time to make a decision. But it's a huge year for them this year because the way they do things, they can't really lose because I think it's important that this season that they do go in the Premier League. And if they don't go in the Premier League, then they will lose a fair chunk of the squad that they've got now. But because of the way the scouting system is, they'll get a lot of money coming into the club and then they can be confident that they replace those players with like for like again.
Well, I mean, a couple of times in the last few years, they've got to January and they've said, all right, we're not going to make it. Let's sell the players. Mm. And they sell them and rely on the scouting in the summer. So, yeah, it's they are very, very efficient. And obviously, they've got a link with Michelin in Denmark and sort of... and use that link and that network to bring people in.
Yeah, they've also got a new stadium coming up. While we're talking about Bournemouth, or the new, potentially a new Bournemouth anyway, Eddie Howe looks like he's been offered a new longer-term contract, about £4 million a year. Is that, again, the club getting taken out insurance just in case he moves on? If he does move on, or should he move on, really?
I think it's best for both parties. Like I said, it's insurance for the club, but for him, while the club's still improving and he's moving it on, and season on season they're still getting better and you can see the improvement there, then I don't think there's any really, unless he gets one of these offers that he can't refuse. You know what the job's like these days, you know, he could move somewhere else and be out of a job in 6 months' time, so why risk what he's got now when he's got a lot of control over the club, a lot of control over who he brings in, and like I said, improvement again year on year.
He's a very realistic manager. You know, when he was linked with both England and Arsenal, he said, let's all just calm this down. You know, I'm not ready. So, yeah, I think it's a good move for him. And I think eventually he will move to a bigger club, inverted commas. But I think he's got plenty of work still to do at Bournemouth. Mm-hmm.
Now, I know a couple of, let's say, resting managers at the moment who are just waiting for the carnage to unfold. Not in this transfer window, but in the next transfer window in October. Which Premier League manager is currently most vulnerable, do you think, David?
Well, I mean...
Pellegrini?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, he's got to be. You know what I mean? No matter what he's standing in the game or or what the potential of the team has. I think, I've seen West Ham a couple of times a season. I think going forward, I really like Felipe Anderson. I think keep Arnautovic fit. You know, they look a threat going forward, but at the back, they just they look woeful. And they've been lucky that they've got Lucas Fabianski, who's had to play really well to keep the score down in a couple of games.
Mm. You've seen him much?
Yeah, no one's putting in a shift. They're not working for each other. The midfield's porous. The defence is disorganised. And you know what? The players, if they're not working, they've always got the excuse, haven't they? They're like, oh, the board are a mess. And Pellegrini, you know, he was brought into Man City as a babysitter to keep the job warm after the chaos of Mancini. And he won the title in his first year, won the League Cup, won another League Cup. But, I mean, there was feeling coming out of the City dressing room that he wasn't dynamic enough. You know, the tactics were a bit flat. And, you know, he did babysitting. The kids went to sleep. You know, and so it's not the sort of manager you need at a place like West Ham, which is carnage. Mm-hmm. It was just the worst appointment. Despite spending £100 million, in the transfer market this summer, this was the most foreseeable crisis in the Premier League ever.
So it's no points after four games. There are Everton on Sunday. Then they've got Chelsea, Manchester United, Spurs at home with a brief respite of an away trip to Brighton. Which won't be easy. Are we looking at this season's Crystal Palace, who ended up with all it no points after seven, eight games?
Yeah, but I mean, the difference between them was that I think if you look at it, you know, talk about the analytics, you talk about the numbers with Palace last season, they were actually playing quite well, and I think it was against Newcastle, they should have won against Newcastle, and they deserve more out of those games that than what they got. So it was always going to turn round for them, where with West Ham, you know, when it was down to individual performances and, you know, like, you know, it's a Diop. He's not played many games yet. He's still integrating himself into the squad. And maybe that's going to be saving grace. The people turn around and say, well, in all these players that came in the summer, they still need a little time to gel.
Mm. You know, as usual, at the end of an international break, we've got a couple of really tasty Premier League matches to get our teeth into. The BT Sport game is Watford against Manchester United on Saturday tea time. Javi Garcia, who basically we all dismissed as yet another light bulb manager, has done extremely well. He's now saying, why can't we be the new Leicester?
Well, probably because you haven't got the players who are that good as Leicester, you know. But certainly they can cause a splash. I mean, obviously, the way Troy Deeney approached the Tottenham game, if United aren't, if they're not focused and they're not, you know, if anyone's not going to, you know, put in a shift for the manager, they're going to get found out by Watford. So, I mean, I doubt they'll be the new Leicester, but we thought the old Leicester weren't going to go very far. And, but, you know, more power to them if they can turn over United. I think people will sit up, you know, and Deeney, the scourge of Arsenal, Tottenham, and if he adds United to that, you know, it'll be brilliant.
Yeah, he'll be at it, won't he?
Yeah. Oh. It's been telling what he, I think it was an interview last week, the week before with Troy, and he was talking about the sort of impression that everyone's got of Watford, you know, and then he says from the inside, if you came here at the training ground and see what they're trying to, they're not just sort of, you know, changing things for the sake of it. Everything from the core of the club is being changed so that it can be successful in future years. So it's, yeah, you can't say it's not working for them at the moment.
And he's great. He'll say, you know, I'm going to test whether they're committed. You know, I'm going to ask them the question, you know, do you want this? And yeah, he does.
Because there is that sort of, just slight hint around that United are a bit feckless.
They have been. I mean, that Brighton game, you know, the two centre-halves certainly were in that game. So it's there seems to be, well, there is a lot of pressure, but I think there's also a lot of pressure being brought on by themselves as well, you know. All the talk about the manager, and I think he tripped up again the other night when he went to the England game. I don't know if you saw that. Nice little fall there. But it's, yeah, it just seems to, you know, sometimes it doesn't just rain at pause and it seems to be pouring at Manchester. Mm. Not for the first time, obviously.
No. And also, it's not just about the team, is it? It's about the nature of the club. So when you get someone like Eric Cantona, who is probably the next statue in waiting at Old Trafford, saying there's no fun, there's no creativity, with all that implies, you know, we really should have Pep as our manager, that's bound to have an effect. It's bound to have a resonance, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I mean, There were many heads nodding there. I mean, it's we should have Pep. How do you work that one out, Eric? You know what I'm saying? But yeah, for him to basically slaughter Mourinho in the way he did, that's a big thing. And there's always been people in the United boardroom who were unconvinced by Mourinho, and the muttering's just growing and growing and growing. And you can see a calamity looming there.
Mm. Do you think they're vulnerable at Watford?
Yeah, I do. Watford's got their tails up there. They'll be confident. They look strong. I like that midfield four. They're very narrow in midfield.
Will Hughes has come on well again.
Yeah, he looks a real player now. Sort of, maybe he's took a little bit of time for that step up from Derby, but he's playing well this season. Yeah, likes Kipu and Doucouré. Real strength in midfield and look a real threat to United, I think.
Yeah, Liverpool at Spurs. I think you're going to Wembley. That's, again, one of those fixtures which will tell you an awful lot.
Well, yeah, I mean, last year was a disaster for Liverpool. They were 4-1 defeat. Lovren hauled off after 31 minutes. The only defender who played that day, who'll play on Saturday, is Joe Gomez, funnily enough. And I think the big difference there is the changes in the defence have been massive. And I think it'll be much more difficult for Tottenham. But it's one of those games, even though it's so early in the season, it's a statement game. Both of them want to lay down the marker, both teams. And I should imagine it'll be very tense and tight.
Mm, yeah. I sat here and basically said that Liverpool could become champions. Was I being daft or not?
No, not at all. I think highly plausible, you know. It's just what they're relying on as well. It's not just about what they do. They're relying on other teams to take points off City. That's what they've got to do. Whether they can do that, it's a different matter. It doesn't look like that at the moment, because even City don't look like they're at full tilt, really, compared to last season. But they've still got that quality.
Mm. What's positive for Liverpool is they haven't really clicked yet. The front three, haven't really got going. And they've still won all the games, and I think that's going to be a good thing. The issue for me is whether they can last the course. I mean, last year they peaked too early. They peaked probably in the Roma game at Anfield, and then for May, when they should have been peaking, and in Kiev they were flat. In Pep's first year over here, City sort of were knackered by January, and he realised that. Changed his training methods, slowed things down a little bit, and of course they went on to be champions. Has Klopp done that? Not that I'm aware of. So we'll see if Liverpool can last the distance.
But they do have the squad and the bench now to make changes. I mean, yeah. He took Naby Keita out, was it the last game against Leicester, and put Jordan Henderson in. So he can afford to do that, so they're not expending too much energy in this part of the season.
Mm. Yeah, Tony's talking there in essence about the whole sort of sports science backup that you get these days. How much is that now an end in itself? What is the balance that maybe you go into a football club that you'd have to make between the science, which might say, look, just take that guy out of training for a day or two, or the need to actually gel a team and you say, look, he's playing?
Look, there's a balance, especially, working with sort of under-23s and 18s players. For a little while, they were probably too cautious with players. So when it comes to games, they were probably playing at 70-80%, because when it comes to during the week, they weren't pushing themselves, pushing their levels and the boundaries of the fitness to be able to get through those games. And yeah, it is a balance. I know that it's outside the Premier League, but with Jack Ross last week, he said that he took a risk and overruled his his medical staff to play Jerome Sinclair, because he thought. They were being a little bit too sort of safe with him, and he wanted to push him back into first team action again. And sometimes I think that's what it's kind of, you're the boss, you're the manager, you have to take that responsibility, take on board what the medical staff say, but also sort of, especially if you're an ex-player yourself, you kind of, you know what football.
You know your body.
Exactly. And once you know your players as well, you know what they can and can't do and what they're capable of and who to push and who to hold back.
Mm. It's an emotionally intense football club. You've got an emotionally intense manager. How is Jurgen Klopp dealing with it, do you think?
I think he's dealing with it. I think he's dealing with it well. I think he's doing a very good job. I think I think he is the players are all united behind him. The crowd are certainly united behind him, and I think there is still this sense of progression there. I mean, it seems strange to think that next month he'll be going into his fourth year as Liverpool manager, when it feels so fresh. He still feels new, and there's that feeling of good things happening. He's just arrived, and while he can create that sense, everything will be. Will be happy. I think they do need to. They need to be closer to City for one. They need to pick up a Champions League spot earlier. Ideally, win a trophy and go deep into the Champions League again to keep the sense of momentum going. But I think Klopp's at the moment is the stock's as high as it could be with everyone.
I don't know if Tony agree or disagree with you, but. His strength as a manager and his personality is sort of reflected in the way that his team play as well. But I was just watching the game against Leicester. When Leicester, credit to them, they were on top for, probably the last hour of the game. And it was more to do with Leicester playing well than Liverpool not doing so well. But when his team's under pressure, you can see that he gets agitated and his sort of energy translates onto the pitch as well. It certainly doesn't help. And I think that's why it's so important that he's got Van Dijk and he's got the likes of Alisson. People who are on the pitch, sometimes they can be too relaxed, but then he needs those characters to counteract his own, I think.
I mean, and what they've brought, those two players, is a sense of belief to the rest of the team and Klopp.
Yeah.
With Tottenham, Pochettino was visibly angry with that performance at Watford. He needs a response as well, doesn't he?
Yeah, definitely. And they just looked, they were coasting a little bit, and they let themselves be gone. I think this is a game where you'll want them to come out like they did at Wembley against Liverpool and against United last year. They come out like a storm, and got the ball forward, got it to Harry Kane, Dele Alli driving and caused havoc in the defence. I think he'll be looking for that. I mean, Tottenham have got a little bit of there's a thing between Tottenham and Liverpool growing, after the game at Anfield where the penalties and Harry Kane. I don't think it's a huge rivalry, but Tottenham might feel a bit peeved and thinking that they should be the team everyone thinks is going to challenge City, because they've been the team going forward. In a sense, it's a little bit different to the Klopp situation. Tottenham are a sort of a crossroads where are they going to progress now? They've moved forward each year, but not quite go over the hump and won a trophy. And are they going to progress further? And if they don't this year, then who knows, that team might well break up. I mean, if Real Madrid come calling again, and it's possible, it'd be hard for Pochettino to say no. If they don't win a trophy, do Kane, do Ali, do Eriksen, what do they think about the futures there? I mean, there's only two ways to keep players at a club, and that's win trophies or pay them the going rate and wages, and Tottenham are doing neither at the moment. And I can't see them paying the going rate.
Well, Man City certainly do, on both counts, don't they?
Yeah.
They've got Fulham at home on Saturday. Then they've got a pretty decent run. Probably their big test will be Liverpool on, I think it's the 7th of October. Compared to this time last year, David, how are City?
I wouldn't say they're coasting, but like I said, they certainly haven't sort of hit top form, Kevin De Bruyne's obviously a big miss for them. But they have got the players to compensate for that. They've got a squad to compensate. I think, they have. It's not that they've had to reach top form or top gear yet, so they can, they can be more conservative. And I think that the focus this year is on Champions League. Of course, they want to retain the title. Of course, they want to do that. But I think you're seeing it certainly with squad selection. We talk about Liverpool trying to rest players well. They can do it no problem, City. They've got a huge squad where they can rest players if needed. And that's going to be the focus. The second half of the season is going to be their focus. And so if they're top of the league, close to the top of the league in Christmas, January time, I think they'll be happy with that.
Well, the other thing, we talk about Liverpool not, hitting the top form, Tottenham not, sort of playing to the to their ability, you know, the heights of their ability. And it's the same for City. It's the World Cup hangover, I think, you know, largely. And, you know, going back to Watford, in many ways, that's why it's an opportunity for Watford, you know, with less players who were there. If they get these teams early on, take something from them, because after Christmas, when everything, you know, sort of when everything settles down, it mightn't be quite so easy.
Yeah, because when you're talking about a World Cup hangover, you don't actually have to have been at the World Cup to have the hangover. Leroy Sané is a case in point. Now, he's just withdrawn from the, you know, the Germany squad as well for personal reasons. He's a player with all the talent in the world. Is he facing almost like a premature crisis of his career at City?
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, there's an awful lot of pressure on him, you know, and he's so young. And, you know, he's getting criticism from all sides. And this is where Guardiola will, you know, sort of will show how good he is. I mean, he'll put his arm around him, you know, and sort of encourage him. And I think some of the criticism is unfair. But, I mean, it's hard for young players to stay focused all the time. And, you know, because there's so many distractions.
Mm. Arsenal, they have a distraction, it seems, internally. You know, there's some talk about Emery being unhappy that the future of Ivan Gazidis, the chief exec, isn't very clear. It's talk about him going to Italy. But Arsenal, if you look at them, are relatively stable compared to Newcastle. What's your assessment of that current situation?
Well, from what I've seen so far of Arsenal, they a little bit like West Ham. You know, they're great going forward, but at the back, they're having some real problems, not just with Petr Cech and playing out the back, but it's more to do with there was a defensive unit. And, you know, it's the same problems that persisted for God knows how long, like, you know. So again, it's a transition period. They're under a new manager, so it's still settling down for them. But I mean, I think it was at the game last year when Newcastle beat Arsenal at St James's. So it's not going to be an easy place for them to go.
What was your assessment of Newcastle as well? Because, again, you know, you've got the whole circus still around the potential sale or non-sale, Mike Ashley, Rafa. Where's all this heading?
Well, the best thing that happened in Newcastle was the window closed. And then so they could just get on with, you know, there's no talk because, you know, of course, Rafa's been very vocal about sort of his displeasure at not being able to bring people in and not being the quality that he wants to bring in. But again, while he's still there, they'll always, say do well, they'll always be clear of relegation.
Not entirely sure.
I think so. I think it'll be clear of relegation. And I think that, OK, they're having a great start of the season. But, you know, like I said, with a manager like that, they're going to.
You know Rafa really well, Tony. What's his current state of mind, do you think?
He thinks it'll take a miracle. But he's worked miracles before, Istanbul, you know, so it's not out of the question. But the thing is, what strikes me about this game, there's only one way that Newcastle can win it, and that's if Arsenal try and play the ball up from the back like they've been doing. Because Rafa will be watching them, and he'll be watching Wales on last week, Aaron Ramsey getting the ball at his feet, you know, and sort of 20 yards from goal. If they try and do that, Rafa will press them high, and they'll get the ball in areas where they get at that defence and that disorganisation in that defence. And that's the only way they can beat them. I can't understand managers like Emery who come in and they look at a group of players who can't do something and say, all right, we're going to do this. Mm. You know, we're going through a process. We're going to teach you how to do it live on the pitch with points at stake. To me, that's just absolute abject madness. And, you know, I think Arsenal have loads of problems. I think Newcastle will have issues scoring goals. And, you know, they're not great defensively. But if Arsenal play the way they've been playing, they'll give Newcastle a chance.
Mm. Chelsea at home to Cardiff, who by common consent have got very little chance of staying up. And, you know, even Warnock saying they've got the hardest job of the lot. Interesting that Rudiger was basically saying that Eden Hazard, he's second only to Messi. Is that just him looking after his mate?
No, not really, I don't think. You know, he's certainly put him above Neymar at the moment, so on form. Even watching him against Scotland, you know, the goal he scores is just ridiculous. He's
Yeah, he's key to them having any success this season. Yeah. But with Cardiff, I mean, it's difficult to see like where they're going to get the points from. But the one pleasing thing I think from if I was a Cardiff fan is the fact that they haven't gone big. They haven't gone and spent a boatload of money. So if they do go down, and this should be the plan, they go down, they're still in a healthy position to come up in the next two seasons. And then if they do come up again, then they'll be even stronger still. Mm. And if they're not strong enough to stay up again and they get relegated, they'll be in this even stronger position to go back up. So it's about building gradually rather than trying to stay in that division and ruin themselves for the next few seasons. Because, I mean, it was a bad financial situation last time they went down.
Mm. Just going back to Hazard, I mean, sometimes he's frustrating because you look at him, he's got so much. And you think to him, you know, in his Chelsea career, why hasn't he, you know, sort of dominated more games? Why hasn't he? And then you think about it. He's been there since 2012. Sarri's a sixth manager. Mm. Six managers in those 6 years. Mm. And that kind of encapsulates Chelsea's dysfunction in the moment. And that's why, although they've had such a good start, I can't see them maintaining the way they're picking up points like this. Mm. I don't see them as contending for the title, but I think I have to agree that Hazard is probably at the moment the second best player in Europe and has the potential in the next couple of years to become the best.
Mm. Yeah, just a final point on Chelsea, where someone who's indelibly associated with them, JT, John Terry, Spartak Moscow, we're told. That's a strange one, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, he's one of them that came totally out of the blue as well, wasn't it? Mm. I don't know. I don't know too much about Spartak Moscow's situation where there was
a... I think they're going to pay him 1.3 million quid a year, which probably is
the back in the secure van, up to his house and shoveling money in. Why wouldn't you go? Yeah.
Oh, no, I mean, from his point of view, I'm just asking why they would want him to go there, you know, because it's... Like I said, it's we know his strengths, which he's always had. He's got a great defensive instinct, but he needed looking after sort of pace wise while he was at Aston Villa. So he won them well.
Yeah,
is a Russian league best for him.
I hope it doesn't end in tears like the last time in Moscow.
Very good, very good. Right, just a final thing, ending with a player who maybe is a one man club, Wilf Sahar. What do you think of him? Palace are. Playing Huddersfield at the weekend, they need to get going again. Sahar, to me, is the embodiment of a one-man club.
Oh, yeah, without him, they've got huge problems, haven't they? He gives them pace, he gives them width, he gives them incisiveness, he gives them an attack. Yeah. And, you know, it's when you look at Benteke, who should be doing more, notwithstanding the fact that he had a bad injury, and he still doesn't give them enough. Zaha is vital to Palace's season. With him, I think they finish there and thereabouts, so the middle of the table. Without him, then it's going to be a long, tough season.
Mm. He's even paying the wages for the women's team.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's just signed a new deal there as well, and which is a smart move because I think. We saw what happened in Manchester United. Of course, he's matured. He's so much more capable of going to a top six side and flourishing. But from Steve Parrish's point of view, you just want to do everything you can. If the money's there, give it to him and keep him there. Yeah. And he can be Palace's Letizia. And that money's small for whatever he gets. It's pennies compared to what he earns the club and keep them in the division.
And also, say January they come looking for a player. Come and play with Sahar. He attracts people's attention.
Well, do it. Make it his club. If he's that integral to the side, like I said, they don't win games without him. So why don't? I don't know who's the club captain at the moment, but do everything to build that team around him. Make him Crystal Palace.
Yeah. Well, I'll admit to being very wrong about Sahar. I once thought he was inconsistent and insubstantial. In fact, he's inspirational. As far as England's concerned, he's the one that got away. Thanks for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.